Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from: a curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. No matter how much you choose to give, you'll feel awesome next time you tune in, knowing that we wouldn't be here without you. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Plus, we have great member swag. Show off your HRN pride with a t-shirt, or keep your hands safe in the kitchen with an HRN potholder. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. Caitlin.
Andrew.
How are you feeling?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm not so great.
What do you mean?
Well, we are sitting here at the end of the Thanksgiving holiday weekend. It is Sunday night. The sun has set. And I find myself, despair would be too strong a word, but I find myself a little despondent over the fact that this weekend has come and gone, and I accomplished, I don't even know if a fraction of what I wanted to accomplish would be the way to put it, because I don't think I accomplished anything I wanted to accomplish this weekend.
We slept.
That's not an accomplishment.
Yes, it is. We went to the movies. That's an accomplishment.
No.
We saw
that's a passive activity.
We saw some friends.
The movie was great, by the way. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is a flawed movie because of some screenplay issues. But I believe it is a great movie. I think it might win Best Picture. But that's an aside. Go ahead.
Sam Rockwell was pretty amazing. Okay, so we saw movies.
Yes.
We saw friends. We slept.
We saw a few friends. But again, this is almost another passive activity. And I'm not putting down John and Heather, who are our next door neighbors, who we adore. But they're our next door neighbors.
We had to walk over there. I'm just saying. Stop minimizing.
Okay, but look, we live 30 minutes from Midtown Manhattan. On a weekend that people make movies about, the Thanksgiving holiday weekend in New York City, it's this amazing time of year. We didn't get to the city once.
I know.
And I look back at the beginning of the holiday weekend and how I almost feel like a guy in a movie having this flashback. And the flashback is I'm thinking about the beginning of the holiday weekend when these 4 days seem stretched out in front of me like this just endless landscape of time, possibility, promise. I had writing I wanted to do. I had people I wanted to see. I had thinking I wanted to do, planning I wanted to do. And it's like I blinked and it's Sunday night. I don't know where the time went. And I'm just really, I don't know. I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed in myself. I'm disappointed at how quickly time shoots by. And I just find myself full of regret. I'm not you don't have to worry about me. I'm not like clinically depressed or anything like that. But I do sit here going like, what happened? It just feels like another Sunday night that where the weekend flew by. This is funny.
Well, it's a little,
I don't think it's funny.
I think
maybe that, from the outside it's funny.
I honestly think this is why you're married to me.
Maybe you're the yin to my yang.
Because I look at 4 days of sleep and I feel like I won the lottery.
Oh my God, it's such a waste of time.
Oh, it's really not. I feel totally recharged for the week.
Here's what I feel like. I feel like it's almost December 1st. And I'm starting to look to 2018, and it's sort of like the way I looked at this past weekend. There's all this promise and possibility and a whole new year stretched out in front of me. But now I also find myself looking back at 2017, much as I'm looking back at this weekend, and thinking, well, what did I get done in 2017? All these things I didn't get done in 2017.
You have 4 more weeks. You have four more weeks. You could do so much in 4 weeks.
Oh, that's so cute. That you're, I mean, you're so optimistic. 4 more weeks. You can't turn around 11 months of...
You totally can.
No, you can't. And this is what I think. I think this all is a metaphor for life. I think if you're lucky enough to live a long life and to not kind of go, you know, unexpectedly, that you sit there and you go... It's like the end of the Thanksgiving weekend. You go, oh, there's all this stuff I wanted to get done. I can't believe I didn't get it done. Like in The Godfather when he says, we just didn't have enough time, Michael. I think that's what it's like. I really think this weekend is at least for me and my warped sense of, I don't know, my sense of not feeling entitled to relax, not feeling entitled to downtime. I don't know. I was just the part of being a writer, I guess, that I've never gotten used to is, you know, where's the off switch?
Okay. I think we need to turn this around.
For yeah.
You.
With what?
With this. Let's talk about the interview.
All right. I mean, that is why we're here.
That
right?
is why we're here.
Okay. Well, this interview is, I have to say, a person in the chef world who I find to be utterly unique in all kinds of ways. Elise Cornack was the chef and owner with her wife, Anna. And Anna, I don't want to butcher your name. I'm really afraid I'm going to. Hieronymus. I'm going to spell it. It's Hieronymus. Anna, if I mispronounced it, please forgive me. You know I love you. But Elise and Anna had this restaurant, Take Root, for about 5 years in Brooklyn, New York. It was a singular restaurant. First of all, Elise is an amazing chef who used to be an artist and has a very distinct palette, a very distinct visual style. And Take Root was a 12-seat, one seating a night restaurant. It was only open a few nights a week, which just by me saying it, I mean, the number of people who were privileged to eat there is we're a small group who ate there.
Did it feel like a dinner party?
You know, people asked, it did not. I think some people might say, oh, that's more a dinner party than a restaurant, but it did not feel at all like a dinner party. And a lot of that owed to Anna's contribution, which is she created a different musical, I mean, mix. It sounds like mixtape and that sounds too casual, but she created this different musical montage, let's call it, for each menu. So every time Elise changed the menu, Anna created a different musical experience. And even though there were only 12 seats in the restaurant, it wasn't a communal table. There were I think it was 4 seats at the counter, and then there were a couple of tables in the room. And I sat there at a deuce with my bestie, Evan Sung, who's a lot of people listening to this might know, one of the best food and chef photographers around. And we sat at our little two-top table and we were instantly like in our own little cocoon. We were sort of plunged into this intimacy. We started having really intense conversations, right away. And it just sort of took you in. It sort of, the whole place just sort of enveloped you. And so, no, I didn't feel like I had, I don't know what anyone else in the restaurant was talking about. We didn't talk to them. We weren't comparing notes on food. And they were a few feet away from us. I mean, it was a real accomplishment on that level. The two of them, and this is a restaurant, by the way, that had just enormous critical success. They had a Michelin star, and they were also unique in that realm in that it was literally just the two of them. Mm-hmm. So Elise did all the cooking, Anna did all the front of house stuff, and the two of them ran plates to diners or guests. I don't know which word they prefer. And then they also did everything behind the scenes. The night Evan and I were there, we were the last two people to leave, and Elise was starting to do the dishes. I mean, there literally was not another employee of this restaurant. So as you can imagine, after about 5 years, this got to be too much for reasons that have been written about. It's not worth going into, I don't think, here. We do get into a little bit of that in the interview, as well as some reasons that have not been written about. And they packed it in, and they moved up to Saugerties, New York. They live up in, literally in the woods. And when I started this show at the end of the summer, I very much wanted to have Elise on the show as part of the first season, because I'd done an interview with her for my blog, Tokeland, and found her to just be so just direct, open, willing to what I call play ball as an interview subject. I felt very comfortable asking her anything, and we kind of picked up right away when I got up there. She was kind enough, and I was flattered by this, to surprise me with lunch when I showed up there from their garden. And that was it. And I have to say, right after we announced the show, Elise reached out to me saying she'd love to be on, and I was already thinking that way. So it took just with scheduling and finding a day where I could be away from the family on a weekend and where she was around and available. It just took a little bit of time. But I was glad we were able to get it into this first season, because I really do enjoy talking to her, and I really do think this interview was very open, honest, revealing.
Yeah, she's great. This is a great interview.
Thank you. And that's all I have to say about it. So I'll let you all get to it. Here it is, my interview with Elise Cornack, recorded about a week ago in Saugerties, New York. I hope you enjoy it. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. So we're pretty far up here.
Absolutely. Most certainly we are.
The drive up was beautiful.
Yeah.
And then the drive up, I won't give away your location, mm-hmm. but you know, when I saw the little sign, mm-hmm. I think posted to a tree for your road.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, these guys have really made a change.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. It was an abrupt actual change, but in conception, it actually began many years ago. The idea of wanting to move up here, you know, we decided that we wanted to live upstate full time at some point when we met. Like, that's how long ago.
Which is how long ago? When did you two meet?
So we have been together 7.5 years. So literally that long ago. And it wasn't until a couple years into our relationship that we took our first visit upstate, in quotes.
Uh-huh.
You know, on a sleepy Sunday in February when the streets were covered in snow and nothing was open and nothing was even going on in Hudson except for Fish and Game had just opened.
Okay.
And so Anna took me up there for Valentine's Day dinner to just see what was going on. So that's how we even ended up up here in any capacity.
Wow. Well, February is a good test of whether or not you can make it up here.
No, it's really true. And we only ever came up in the winter for the first few years because we were, even though we were the same level of busyness in terms of the restaurant all seasons every month, it felt less energetically busy in the winter. Mm-hmm. So that was when we would feel like we could take the day away to drive upstate and explore.
So first of all, I have to say, it would have been bad radio to actually be eating it on the air, but I showed up and you had very kindly prepared some lunch. What did we just have? What was the lunch
so
we just had?
It's really
funny. It was delicious.
Something I 100% gained from my mother was the ability to put food together when there's literally nothing in the house. And so the other day I finally thinned out our garden with some carrots and radishes and stuff that was left over.
So those did come from
your
garden?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. Okay. It was the last of it. I mean, the garden's now just dirt. And I had some lentils in the pantry. So we had some lentils and this past weekend I did a event with my friend, and we had some leftover homemade whipped brown butter. So we had the vegetables with that and some, turmeric baguette rolls that I had made a few days ago. So all things are either in the freezer or the pantry
and the
or
vegetable,
in the ground.
You called it a vegetable tea?
Yeah. So the vegetable tea is, kind of my answer to the you know, broth, you know, trend that's happening right now, but also in collaboration with the vegetable forward trend that's kind of happening right now, in that not everybody wants to have like a meaty flavor in the morning or in the afternoon. So this is, you take vegetables, kind of dehydrate them and roast them in the oven until they become looking like tea leaves. And then you steep them the same way you'd make tea versus like boiling it or simmering it the way you'd make a broth.
Got it.
So it's very clear, but really intense in flavor.
And I'll just set the scene for people listening. We're sitting in your very, very well, I want to say well-windowed space. I mean, there's windows on, gosh, basically all four sides, essentially. We're at your dining table, and there's light coming in from all around. And this is your life now.
This is absolutely, the light, I'm really happy that you're noting the light right now, because it's funny that, I mean, we're everywhere. It's dark at around 3:30, but up here in our house is situated in the center, a bullseye of 6 acres of land that are primarily woods, if you can look outside and see. So it gets not only dark, but also like very dark after like 3:30. Yeah. And there's not a single light through the woods that you can see. And so these windows provide everything you need during the day to keep you going until 3:30.
Got
and then
it.
It becomes pretty pitch dark.
Does it ever get spooky at night?
For me, no. For my wife, absolutely. She get.
Where did she grow
staying
up?
Here, she actually grew up in the middle of 50 acres of land.
Okay.
With a lot of woods and a lot of darkness. So you'd think she would have been, you know, kind of groomed for it.
Yeah.
But coming out of the city, when you have that company and you know somebody's below you, on either side of you, above you.
That density of population.
And even if no one is home in any of the apartments you're living in, there's someone on the street.
Yep.
Or someone outside your window.
Yeah.
That feeling of aloneness doesn't really set in the way it does. So she's only done a couple nights alone in the house.
Okay.
Less psyched about it than I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you, you know, you were in the city. You had this hot restaurant. I thought it had, honestly, I mean, longer ago. I thought it was longer ago. I feel like you've been gone longer than you've actually been gone.
Feels that way to me as well. Even
it
though,
does.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's been only about, what,
yeah,
6 months?
Yeah, 6 months. Yeah.
So what's, you know, a lot of people think, even forget moving to a place that's, you know, up in the woods, which you just literally are. That's that's not a derogatory statement.
Yeah.
You know, but even when people leave to go to another, like when Gavin Kazin left to go to Minneapolis, you know, and people, and it's happening more and more that people, chefs are leaving the city. You know, I think the people who stay behind, whether or not they'll say it directly to the departing chefs, they do kind of wonder, like, well, aren't they nervous they're going to miss out on, like, the media coverage and the scene and the this and the that? Having been away for 6 months, what's the mindset that you have? Do you feel that way at all? Is there any anxiety around that? Does it feel kind of nice to be away from all that? Like, just what's your kind of mental state about the profession?
So it's really interesting, because I feel like I can separate the personal and professional point of view on that question, in that from a professional standpoint, I don't really have any anxiety about, you know, coverage or media, primarily because the time we put in the city, it's honestly, it's paid off in more ways than I can imagine. It's not just, you know, press or features or coverage or interviews or writing. It's friendships, you know, it's understanding, it's networking, not on for business, you know, reasons, but for like legitimate, genuine relationship reasons. And these are people that care about myself and Anna. They care about our food. They care about our point of view, our vision, and our next step. So, you know, it's not like I'll scratch your back, you'll scratch mine type of thing. It's really just genuine interest in what we do and vice versa in our friends who are, you know, in the media side of things. So I do genuinely feel supported. So I think that kind of makes me feel secure in the situation. And then secondly, I think that our kind of quote move to do this has created that kind of blank space at the end of the sentence where like people are going to wonder what we're going to fill that blank space with. So that intrigue, that interest, especially coming off of doing something pretty unorthodox.
Yeah.
I think there is an interest. Like what are these two relatively crazy people who operate a restaurant alone for 5 years going to do next? Like, are they going to do another thing like that? Are they going to do something totally different? So I think that, you know, those two things professionally kind of make me feel pretty safe. Personally, I'm a little bit more nervous because, so it's interesting. We were just saying to somebody yesterday that I would be less afraid to open a restaurant in the city than I would be up here. And part of that is because if you open a restaurant in the city, and just just, you know, mind, bear with me for a second. And it does well. Wonderful. And it doesn't do well. You can kind of fade into the distance if you'd like to. I mean, there's so many things opening constantly on a daily basis that you can kind of fly under the radar and just, you know, operate your neighborhood spot, right, push out some decent, you know, thoughtful food and not really worry about being a part of the scene, yeah, if you want to. Up here or anywhere that's beginning, that's starting, that's gentrifying, that's, you know, progressing or moving forward or growing, you are in the center focus when you open something new, sure, because it's so needed, it's wanted, or the opposite, it's not needed or wanted by, you know, the locals. And because of the fabric of the community up here, you have like three or four different kind of categories of people. You have the weekenders,
yep,
who are coming up and just enjoying, you know, either the nature or what's here. You have people who are just moving up here, like the transplants, mm-hmm, which we have a small community of, and you immediately have that thing in common and you're all excited about what each other's doing because, yeah, you're all from the city. And then and then you have the other groups, which are the locals that have, you know, lived up here for 15, 20 years, but still probably came from the city. And then the locals who have been born and bred here and never,
yep,
left.
Yep.
In the city, you have many more kinds of people, but none of them all give a shit about what you're doing.
Right, right.
Up here, everyone gives a shit about what you're doing. Everyone, right, has a very serious invested opinion on what's going to happen in their small town next.
How are you aware of that? I mean, do you hear it from people directly? Is it?
Oh, I mean, Anna and I have been talking about this topic with people up here since we started coming up here. For 5 years, we've asked people, from a shop owner to a restaurant owner to a, you know, a bus, somebody busing our table, to a neighbor.
Yeah.
Everybody we ask their opinion on where, yeah, they live, why they moved here, or how long they've been here, what do they need or want, what are they,
yeah,
interested in. What,
yeah.
And it's just basically field research. And we've been doing it for years. When we even owned a restaurant in the city and we're living there full time, we were already thinking way ahead about what is it going to be like, where are we going to live, which side of the river.
Yeah.
Like, so we've done our research. That's part of the reason we know. And also we're very sensitive, pretty thin-skinned people. So we're looking to kind of find a place where we feel like we fit in and that it's, you know, we're both a necessity and intriguing and not, right, intrusive.
It's funny. We used to have a place up here, mm-hmm, or not on the other side of the river, but, mm-hmm, upstate, and toyed with the idea at one point of maybe doing a restaurant with a chef friend of ours. It seemed to me that the big fear for a lot of people, among other ones, but the big one is this sort of fear of winter. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you get through a winter? Does that come up a lot?
Absolutely. For me, it's interesting. I grew up, my family very fortunately has a summer house in Nantucket. They've had, yep, it for 30 plus years. So very long time, when Nantucket was a very different place, yep, than it is now. And I started my career working in restaurants in Nantucket. The chefs that I worked for there were, you know, great inspiration as to my idea of wanting to move somewhere that was relatively remote, that was not busy in the winter. And I've always loved a seasonal lifestyle. I mean, that's been something that I've aspired to at a very young age, before I was even in the industry. The idea of like pushing really hard for 8 months of the year and then, right, four, shutting down, you know, hibernating in the way
literally
that,
shutting
literally
down.
Literally and figuratively shutting down. I mean, maybe not 4 months, but, you know, a certain period. A lot of the restaurants up here do close for the month of January.
Right. Or you go to like a 3 or 4 day schedule
or that. Yeah. But, you know, off the top of my head, I know Fish and Game, they close for, you know, end of February till the beginning of April, and like full doors shut. Because when you think about it, it's not really about, oh, we don't have customers. That's right. It's also just about the lifestyle you're signing up for up here, where you get to kind of hibernate and go inward, and things are literally dark and things are literally, right, quiet. So you do get to have that moment of reflection and then reopen when the excitement of spring and summer are there. And so I, right, think it's, you know, healthy and it's suitable for certain people. And I happen to be one of them.
Yeah. So you just mentioned spending time in Nantucket, mm-hmm, when you were young. Mm-hmm. I would love to talk about your backstory a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Because, which I wanted to do anyway, but it's funny, you know, this season, this whole sort of question, and I feel a little funny even bringing it up, because I think it's starting to sound a little facile on my part. But, you know, the whole question of food and whether or not it's art, mm-hmm, at all, mm-hmm, and your background literally was in art. So I'd love to kind of maybe talk about that a little as we go through your transition into the chef world. But just tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what sort of the circumstances were. What was your
childhood
like?
So I grew up just outside Boston. My, yeah, family still lives there. And my dad had been going to Nantucket since he was just, you know, early into his college years, working as a bartender there, and kind of fell in love with the island in a geographical sense.
Yep.
And my mom and he actually sail there on their honeymoon, and they ended up buying this tiny little house, exactly the same size as it was the day they bought it, just outside town. And so we spent half of our year there when we were really little. And then as we got older and school was, you know, more and more important, we could only go during allotted vacations. You know, they wouldn't take us away during school year as much. But still, my life, my memories, the foundation of who I am as a person and also culinarily, all stems from Nantucket, not from Boston. I have very little association with the mainland when it comes to, you know, my creative side of myself.
Yeah.
I mean, even my family memories are more based there than they are. So
does that setting, I mean, I grew up in Coral Gables. I grew up 2 miles from the University of Miami in South Florida, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think about a setting like Nantucket, right? Yeah. And I just think, you know, Gilbert Gottfried used to have this great joke that, you know, in ancient Rome, people would walk around saying, this is a really long time ago.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I always think if you grew up in a place like Nantucket, did it feel like something out of a movie? Did it feel like something out of a dream?
Oh.
Did it feel that special, or was that just your life?
Oh, no, it did feel that special. I mean, I said the word fortunate because it should be underlined and bolded and in italic. I mean, that's like what, like 1%, not 0.1% of the country that can afford both financially and otherwise to have that kind of lifestyle.
Sure.
So it was not lost on me as a kid at all.
Yeah.
That what we had was extremely lucky and very special to be able to have this place to go to. I remember taking the two ferry rides I always remember was the first one of the season when we go over and the last one when we leave, because my mom would stay all summer long with us and never, my dad went back and forth for work, but... And it was this moment of you're signing up. It was bigger than summer camp. It was bigger than vacation. It was like a lifestyle shift. So you'd go, and all of a sudden, the second you arrived the first day of summer, like, you didn't leave. And I worked at a very young age. At, you know, 12 years old, I started to work at a donut shop on the beach, get up at 5 a.m. and bike myself down there and do this. And so it was not all, you know, hanging out and playing. My parents were pretty strict on us having summer jobs and whatnot. But it did feel very surreal. I mean, the opportunities were endless. Our parents trusted us, you know, because where could we go? There was nowhere for us to go. We were literally
on an
island.
So you were just out like on a bike?
All the time.
Yeah, just
all day long we were with our friends, and all night long we were with our friends. And we would, you know, call when we were coming home or whatnot, or we'd be at a friend's house. But we could walk into town. We could walk to the beach. We could walk to the lily pond where we could run around and play hide and seek. I mean, everything was at our fingertips. And also, there was beaches and sun and ocean. And
amazing.
So yeah, it was legitimate paradise as a child. And it wasn't until I got older that I also started to see everything else that came with this place, which was the social, economic kind of community that was coming and going, even the ones that my family was a part of as summer people, as people who had second homes, and then how that collided with people who lived there full time.
Yeah.
And how that information has now become so valuable to me as a newcomer into a place where there is this, again, collision of, you know, weekenders, summer people, and also locals.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's been valuable.
You mentioned working in a donut place when you were a kid. Did you at that time have any notion that you would end up becoming a chef?
I was massively fascinated with food and cooking and restaurants. I had no idea that it was a viable like career path.
You did
for me as a person or as like a woman.
What was interesting about it to you?
You know, it's funny. I always think this is hilarious because of how we ended up running our restaurant as just the two of us. But I loved the community aspect of showing up and being kind of like this motley crew of people that were just all totally different.
Yeah.
Usually from the dishwasher to the people who owned it. But somehow had this common place that they congregated, and it just was really special to me in that way. And I also just loved food. So of course that was part of it.
Right.
But I felt like there were so many possibilities. I mean, you could do anything in a restaurant. I mean, you could be really anybody you wanted to be, and there were so many different kinds of jobs that made the place work. You know, so
were you were you making donuts? Were you selling?
So,
what was your job?
It was kind of a mashup of responsibility because I was so young. I mean, I was turning 12 that November, and me and this other girl at the time would be the counter girl. So we would, you know, take people's money for the donuts, and then also, you know, if there were, you know, needing help in the kitchen, we would be powder sugaring the donuts and stuff like that, loading the flour bins, whatnot. And then after that, I ended up working at a bagel shop as well, where I did more baking.
You did. Did you have a natural aptitude even as a kid? Like, did you have like good hands, as they say, or soft hands?
Yeah, it's funny. Just a couple of days ago, my wife said this, and it had occurred to me that I guess it's true, but it sounds really like lofty to say it of yourself. But I am very talented when it comes to things with my hands. Like they come pretty naturally to me. Art, drawing, painting, cooking things with food. I don't really know.
They know what to do?
Yeah, they just do it.
Yeah.
It's very, but I don't imagine I could. I always laugh with my dad. I'm like, I don't imagine I could do what you do. He's a surgeon. So I'm like, I can't even sew. So I think that maybe it's just like a creative.
Well, you
thing,
don't just kind of want to like let your hands go in that profession.
That's a little, see exactly. what happens. I always laugh because when I was little, my dad sewed our like holes in our pants and stuff. And he always said, you know, if I can sew a human skin together, I think I can do this. But so within a certain, you know, category of things, my hands are
within reasonable,
within reasonable
non-life-threatening
reach.
Limitations.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. But you didn't start out heading for the kitchen. How did you became an artist?
Yeah. So I was constantly being creative when I was little, when I wasn't.
Meaning what? What kind of thing?
Oh, just anything. Literally, I was building things in the forest, making fairy houses, painting, drawing, gluing shit together. I mean, everything.
All at the same time?
All
I mean,
the
you
time.
Would just flip back
just
and forth
back
among
and forth
whatever struck your fancy.
Yeah, I played some music for a little while. I just always wanted to be creating or doing something that was mine, that was coming from within me.
Was this exceptional among, you're describing a Massachusetts upbringing of some privilege.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it spent in Nantucket. Were there other kids that kind of were comparable to you in this regard, or were you sort of exceptional in the way that you, I guess, expressed yourself or with this level of creativity? Did it seem unusual?
I think there was definitely other talented children where I was growing up based on just the fact of who I was growing up around. But I also always wonder, was that just an inflated perception because the parents and the schools of these places, because they were so privileged, were making everyone feel that they were so great? I'm serious. I've always thought about it. I'm like, you know what? Was it good? Were we good? Were we talented?
Right.
Or was it just, you know, what people wanted us to believe, because of the path and the kinds of people that I grew up around.
Right.
Again, not something I've thought about until I became an adult.
Well, when you look back and you think about
looking
the stuff
back,
you were
absolutely.
Doing, did it
I mean,
seem
I,
good?
Oh yeah. I was selling my artwork as a, you know, teenager on Nantucket for, couple $100 or $1,000 for like a 12x10 inch.
To family friends, or you actually were in a gallery at that point?
No, a couple little galleries.
You did.
And yeah,
that's
I was
amazing.
And you know, when you're 16, 17 years old and you can sell a small painting for $600, it's not like not nothing at that age. It feels good. But it became really clear to me. I remember there was this one painting that got sold to this woman, painting I loved a lot, and I was convinced to put at this little gallery. And I was really devastated that I found out it got bought because I loved it so much.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, now I'm never going to see it again. This is terrible. I hate this. And I remember the woman who owned the gallery contacted the woman who bought it and told her how I felt and was like kind of just expressing, like, just so you know, this is how the artist feels. And I was 16 years old. So like, I don't even know where I got off thinking my point of view mattered.
Yeah.
And the woman ended up sending me a photo of where she hang it in her house. And she's like, you can always keep this and know that it's going to be appreciated. Like every time I walk down this hallway, like, no, that's not. And it was this very strange first moment I had with giving somebody that's a non-family member, something that I created and knowing that it was then out of my hands. And
like,
what they thought of it, who was going to look at it or what they were going to. And I've thought about that moment so many times in my cooking as well, and what that feels like to give something away that you've created.
Right.
So I stopped selling work after that.
It's almost, not to get too exaggerated or too precious about it, because people, you hear songwriters talk about, you know, their songs are like their children. You know, you set them off into the world. But there is this element of you do have to let go.
Of course.
At some point. When I hear you talk about how varied your pursuits were as a kid, I have a 13-year-old daughter, and I came up with this term because I try when I write, I'm tortured.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am not. I think I'm pretty good at the craft of writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's still hard for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much less efficient at it than friends I have.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter has an idea, and she just executes.
Mm-hmm.
It's and like you were, mm-hmm. she does it across all different disciplines. She sews. She draws, she paints, she writes songs, she plays three instruments. There's no barrier from her brain to the concept.
Mm-hmm.
Does this make sense to you?
Oh, yeah.
I came up with this term, creative fluency.
Mm-hmm. First of all, fantastic term for it because it's actually...
Does that describe
how you
think of yourself?
Most certainly, before... maybe 2 years ago. And it's funny, just yesterday or 2 days ago, Anna and I were in the car and I said to her, like out of nowhere, like we weren't talking about anything and I was having one of my like days off thought moments.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I really wish that I could create without you know, any inhibitions. Like, what was that feeling like? Do you remember, when did it stop? And she was like, well, what do you mean? Like, what do you, I was like, when did I stop creating to you? Did it happen when we met? Like, when did I stop creating where I started to feel anxious, you know, would self-criticize every step of the way? Like, when did it stop? And I started to try to figure out, okay, was it a moment? Was it a dish? Was it an interaction? Like, what happened? There had to have been that moment.
So you used to just be able to just flow.
All the way up until probably 2 years ago.
You know what's funny? When I was a kid, the first thing I ever wrote, the Miami News, which was the after, doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. It was an after, I don't think, if it does still exist, I'm sorry, Miami News. But they used to have an every year for Halloween, a thing called the Scary Story Contest. Mm-hmm. And there was like a little kid.
So funny, yeah.
There was a little kid category and then like a junior high and then high school and then adult. Mm-hmm. And I swear this is true. I wrote the story I entered. I had the idea. I wrote the story in 45 minutes, literally. It was short. I mean, it was a very short limit on the thing. And I won the contest, right?
Fantastic.
But I do look back now, and when I first started co-authoring for people, I had a reputation as being like a really good fixer, or they sold the book on a tight time frame and they needed it done, you know, like that, mm-hmm, really fast. Mm-hmm. But something happened to me in my 30s or maybe my mm-hmm. early 40s. I hadn't thought about this in a while. I did used to have that sort of
exactly
fluency, and then I became very self-conscious and much slower.
And exactly right. And it's so funny because...
But you're right. You're just at that point. Is it alarming to you?
Freaking me out.
Yeah.
I guess it's giving me major anxiety.
Yeah. Because you didn't used to be. Your brain's not functioning in the same way.
No. It feels energetically and physically, and I say physically because I learned over the past year something... We can talk about, you know, later on in terms of I had a little bit of a serious like health, you know, mental situation last winter that gave me clarity to the understanding that mental and physical thoughts and feelings are not separate. They're the same.
Yeah.
And I physically feel like there's a mucusy block, excuse me for like the disgusting image, in what I would otherwise see like as clear creative channel. Yeah. Like it just feels like I can't like push beyond this thing.
That's so funny.
I can still create
way.
Something, but it doesn't feel fluid. Like you were saying, it doesn't feel like, when I do it, it feels like,
it's stressful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that feeling is really unnerving, uncomfortable, and something I'm trying to kind of push through and figure out what is it, so I can not only get through and keep doing it through it, get rid of it.
Yeah.
Make it go away.
I wish I had answers for you.
And I think don't. It might, And I have a sneaky feeling it has to do with age and life experience, which I'm afraid of because that means that it's only going to get worse.
Answer.
Exactly.
But it's funny you put it the way you do, because to this day, if I'm having a bad week and someone will say, what's going on? And I'll just say that, you know, the works are all gummed up.
Yeah.
That's what I say. Yeah. I don't know how else to describe it.
No,
it's like
true.
A log jam.
Exactly. That's what it feels like. That's what you know, visually maybe picture. It's a very weird.
And you can get through it, obviously. Yeah. I mean, I have a book coming out and you've
got
stuff.
It's not possible to not create. It's just not as... You know, relaxing.
Yeah, fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay, so you decide to pursue the artist path. Mm-hmm. How did you go about that? What was your main discipline?
So I thought after, you know, dabbling in the idea of selling stuff, this could be a legitimate career for me.
Right.
My parents always took us to the art openings in Nantucket every weekend in, you know, the season in the summer. It's so fun. All the galleries open their doors and you can walk in and out and look at the art and there's wine and cheese. And it was like the collision of everything I love. So it was like good free cheese and wine, which my brothers and I would always sneak, and art. And my parents looked forward to their favorite show every year, which was called the Small Works Show. And it was when up and coming artists would put out things that I think the dimensions had to be under like a postcard size or something like that. And it was a way to like see new work. And my parents always bought stuff during that because they didn't have as much money as they wanted to buy bigger stuff. And as I got older, the people that they invested in became really big and became people's like favorite artists on the island. And I was like totally in awe of a couple of them. One stands out, David Lazarus, and he did very broad stroked palette knife oil paintings. That one's mine actually, right to your left.
Oh, wow.
And it's inspired by his stuff. And it's not pleasing to everybody's eye. It doesn't look like what you're looking at. It's not totally
literal.
Thank you. That's the word. And so I was like, this is really freeing. This is amazing. I want to do this. I want to go to college and do this. And then I want to sell my work. Okay. So that became easy. But I also was an athlete. I wanted to play sports and do whatever in college. My brother went to Bates College. So I said, I'll just do that.
What sport did you play?
I played soccer and lacrosse. Not thinking about going to art school, because to me, I was like, I can create wherever I am. I don't need to be one singular lane. I'd like to explore other lanes as well. And so I did art first 3 years of college. Then it became time for my senior thesis. And I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to paint anymore. I need to do something that's much more minimalist and more controlled. My personality had shifted. I was becoming extremely intense and very minimalist in all ways. And so I switch. I don't have any where you can see. They're all around the house of these very, very fine line drawings, like, and wire. And they were so minimalist, so faint that you could hardly even see them on the gray paper.
Yeah.
And it was a drastic shift from these bold colored, large stroked palette oil paintings. And it was a moment for me as an artist where I realized this genuinely is a reflection of how I'm feeling, of who I am. Art really is an expression. It sounds cheesy, but it genuinely was that. Like, why did it shift so much for me? And I became very clear that I did want to continue to express myself, but that no longer was art going to be the way to do it, because I couldn't settle on a unified vision. And I felt like that meant that I could never be a successful artist, because my art was too intertwined with my emotions and it was constantly changing in a way that would never be consistent enough to actually make money, which was totally self-realized.
Well, I would think it would also, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but going back to what you said before, I would think it would be also that whole thing of letting go of the artwork
would
become even more difficult.
Oh, absolutely.
After you have a revelation like that.
Totally. And I remember my older brother went to Bates as well, and he was an econ major and I was an art and visual culture major. And I remember coming home for holidays and stuff and him kind of bitching to my parents, you know, all she does is paint and draw. You know, you're paying for her to go to college just to do this. It's really nothing. She's just, what is she, a tragic artist? Like, this is, and the reality was, like, yeah, I mean, that is basically what I was doing in college. Right. I mean, I did some essays and some seminars as well, but it became clear that, no, I'm not still painting and drawing, but the experiences I had in college and the professors I had and the students I was working with did still totally play into my cooking career and my creativity as a chef.
Yeah.
Not as obvious to the average person, but to me makes, you know, perfect sense.
So how did you decide cooking was going to be the thing? Or something you wanted to try?
Pretty much was the center of, you know, my family's life when we were growing up. Mom cooked every meal for us, you know, 6 nights a week, essentially. Yep. Dinner on the table by 5:30, we all ate together. And anytime we were not, you know, in school or we were on vacations, we were eating. We were worrying about what we were eating for dinner when we were eating breakfast. And my mom is, Sicilian and Calabrese. She's 100% Italian. Her family food is at the center. So for me, it was always something I really enjoyed and I loved cooking and I did it with her. Again, like I said previously, I never thought it was a career, but then it kind of dawned on me one day, the way that Bates set up their curriculum was that 2 of the years you had something called short term. You could pick any 2 of your 4 years you were there, but that meant your second semester you could go somewhere else. Yep. You didn't have to be on campus. And most kids did internships or they traveled.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to my guidance counselor at the time and said, I would like to go work in a restaurant. This is my junior year of college. She said, no, there's no department where you're going to get credits for that like, under any circumstance. Well, I, of course, fought for it, always doing things my own way, as you know, my parents would recall, and said, I really think that this is necessary. These are the reasons why I think it could still play into my major, because there's no denying that there's creativity and all the, you know, a lot of the applications you use in art in the kitchen. So they okayed it. And I went to work at a restaurant in Nantucket, knocked on their door and said, I'd like to get a job here. And they said, no. Okay. Met with resistance meant I just needed to try harder for me. And I came back with a knife from my mom's drawer at the house. It wrapped it in a dish towel. And I was like, just let me come into the kitchen and do anything. I don't really care.
The same day?
The next day. And the guy who ran the kitchen, he and his wife owned it together. And Amanda was just kind of a little, I recall her having a similar personality to April Bloomfield.
Yeah.
Very intense.
Who ended up working
very intense and hardworking, but there was like this like ability to teach vibe that I was getting from her. And I was like, I'm going to aim to convince her and maybe she'll convince her husband. And so she met with me the following day instead of him. And I was like, please, like I'll do anything. And I said, I'll peel this, I'll clean this. And she was like, all right, let's go talk to Gabriel. Let's go see if that maybe just you can go stand next to the Grand Marché person. The next day I was there doing that. And in the pastry kitchen right behind me was somebody who became a dear friend. She was taking the summer off from working at what used to be Gilt, mm-hmm. in the city as a pastry chef because she had a bad breakup and she wanted to go somewhere for 3 months, get the hell out of the city
and just
like head down making pound cake. Yeah. Like for her, it was like a nothing job, but she wanted to get away from this ex-boyfriend. Yeah. Oh my God. She took me under her wing. I fell completely in love with the industry. And she told me all these stories about late nights in New York City and the chefs that she worked for. And she'd work for Grey Coons and Balut and all these people. And I was just like, oh my God, starry-eyed, couldn't get enough of it, begged them to let me stay. Before you knew it, I was on Garmager station, working my own station, and totally in love with the industry.
All these names you're mentioning, were these people that you were reading about yourself? Or were
after she mentioned the name, I would go home.
No, I mean, before that, like, you were really just more focused on, like, the food at home and the food on the island and, like, the local.
Exactly.
So you were interested in food, but you didn't have a thing about chefs.
No. At the most, I thought, oh, this would be fun to own my own. Because I always loved like, you know, coffee shop culture and like little bakeries. And I was like, oh, maybe I'll do something like that. I'll learn some skills in a kitchen. I had no idea what the quote industry was or anything about what that meant.
So you heard about this almost, I mean, this reminds me of the way people heard about stuff a long time ago. Just it was sort of like folklore.
Oh, yeah. It was
from
amazing.
People who had been there.
The line cook that I became friends with that summer, the people I worked with that summer will like forever, you know, be a major portion of why I ever got into this industry and all the stories. And I was young. I mean, I was 19.
Wow.
And he had worked at, God, I'm blanking right now, Clio in Boston at the time,
which was
like, and he was also taking a summer off and he was working the meat station and they would late nights have cigarettes on the bench and I would sit with them and we would have beers. And I was like, just totally in awe of this idea of this people that came together that were completely different, that were all friends, that had this amazingly kind of ruckus, fun time after service.
Sure.
And I was obsessed. And I asked my dad if I could not go back for my senior year in college by the time the season came up. And he said, like, no, you need to finish it. At this point, you never know what could happen to you or your life. Finish mm-hmm. your college degree, and then you can do whatever the hell you want after that.
Right.
So I had to go back to school come September. I was devastated.
Were you like ripping the days off the calendar?
I was devastated.
Or like scoring the days on the wall, like
it was
in prison?
Like, I couldn't even. I recall going back to the first day of practice for soccer.
Yeah.
And we had to run. This is such a silly story, but I was reminded of it 2 days ago, actually. We had to run 2 miles in a certain time frame to make the team again. And during the 2 miles, I recall getting myself through it because I was very out of shape because I was not exercising that summer because I was working.
Yeah.
All I would do was, in my mind, recite what was in my mise en place on the station to keep myself busy during the 2 mile run.
So funny.
And I recall like going over and I was like celery sliced in the bias, over and over, just like saying things that were on the station just to keep myself from thinking I'm about to die because I'm so tired right now on this run. And it was that moment that became clear, like, this is the thing that I want to do. This is what I want to think about, dream about.
Wow.
And
did you correlate at that point cooking to the sort of feeling you got from art, from being an artist?
Really, no, because there was something about creating art that felt like, and this is like kind of hard to put into words, there was less a sense of community and less a sense of high, I can't really explain it. Basically, I felt like art is everywhere. It's historically a major portion of humanity and mm-hmm. Of culture, but it didn't feel as tangible to me as food did.
Yeah.
And so I didn't see it the same way as I'm creating this, you know, to go on the wall or to be seen in this gallery, to be seen in this museum or to be walked through, whether it be a building or architecture.
Or even at that point, did it even seem expressive to you?
It didn't.
Not yet.
It really didn't. Yeah. It felt more about the job opportunity
mm-hmm.
and the joy.
And a life that you liked and a community.
Exactly.
That you
and
liked.
The literal happiness that we felt when the farmers would drop off amazing produce or the best was the dock. Met the docks in Nantucket met the back of the restaurant and chef was friends with these hilarious fishermen that would come in and bring, you know, half a tuna and everyone would laugh and they'd cut off pieces of the raw meat. And there was just like thrill after thrill after thrill. And it was just like on every level.
That's amazing.
Every sensory experience was firing. Like
you really did grow up in a movie.
looking back, it kind of feels like it, but it was, you know,
they came right up to the back of the dock was
but it was funny because it was like this collision of a million different things happening in my mind between career opportunity, you know, self-expression, creative expression, family and community, because at the same time I was coming out at that time and my family didn't know about it.
Right.
But my kitchen family knew about it.
They did.
And so, And so it felt like this place that was, I was the only person in the world that knew about it. No one that knew me ever came into that world has still, wow, other than Anna, until I met Anna, like no one in my family has any connection with the industry. So it felt like it was my place, my kind of solo adventure.
Was it a safe place to come out?
I didn't like announce it to the universe, but I did tell the close friends I had in the kitchen, mm-hmm, and they were like, cool, whatever, like whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely safe in that sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I hear a lot of people talk about kitchens and, mm-hmm, kitchens as, mm-hmm, early jobs. I was a big theater kid. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of that dynamic. Mm-hmm. It just does. It's people, all different backgrounds, mm-hmm, who were there in a common pursuit, and sort of if you can do the job, you were accepted.
Exactly. Or any do a job.
Yeah.
You know, can you do something meaningful, yeah, and that's contributing to, you know, being productive in some capacity? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, mm-hmm, and then we'll talk about your time in New York and the road to and from Take Root.
Yeah.
We're talking with Elise Cornack. We're up in Saugerties, New York, which is great. And before we go to our break, just a quick reminder, if you'd like to subscribe to the show, you can do that on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you subscribe to your podcast. And if you'd be kind enough to rate the show, or especially if you take a few minutes to write a review on iTunes, we would be very grateful. It does help people find us. We'll be right back after this break. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like the tiny bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes. Not afraid to catch your gaze, ready with all those tricks and games you play, and have a dream about it. Bob Moore is the founder of Bob's Red Mill, the top quality supplier of grains, flours, and general nutritional goodness from Oregon. He's talking to us about their signature millstones, a very specific way of making whole grain flour. So what's the secret, Bob?
Follow me to the mill room. Well, these are just like the millstones that the Romans used to grind their grains. In fact, these stones came from the same quarry near Paris, France, where the Romans got their stones. The company that makes our millstones pulls their quartz from the same quarry, and they make mills for us that are just wonderful.
Bob explains how the millstones grind much slower and at cooler temperatures than modern steel rollers. The process keeps the grains cool, preserving the flavor and nutrition.
Look at what they produce. I love how they keep things simple and just right. All the nutrition is there, just like nature intended.
After almost 40 years in the milling business, they're serving up over 400 organic, gluten-free, and whole grain foods right here from the mill in Oregon, sending them off to destinations around the world.
We think we can make a difference by sticking to the traditional way of stone milling. And so, that's what we're doing.
To learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their mission to bring good food for all, visit bobsredmill.com/podcast.
And we are back talking with Chef Elise Cornack. So, Elise, let's talk about you coming to New York City.
So I actually had decided that I hated New York City at a pretty early age because I thought it was really overwhelming.
How many times had you been there?
A handful of times as a kid. My mom had family in New York City, so we'd gone to see them, and then throughout high school and college, you know, with friends and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I actually had a few best friends from Bates that all grew up in Manhattan.
Okay.
And so, you know, we would go to and from to see them. And one of my best friends, who actually introduced Anna and I, was a friend of hers since he was 5.
Wow.
So that's kind of coming full circle later on. Said, well, will you come to spend New Year's, year of 2009, in the city? We're all going to be there. Come on, like, please come. I was like, no, I really don't want to. At this point, I was decidedly going to move to San Francisco or Seattle. I was choosing between the two. Definitely West Coast. I had no interest in being on the East Coast anymore, specifically not New York. I agreed to just that weekend.
Yeah.
And that following Monday, he said, well, why don't you just go stage at a few restaurants? Like, just try it, just for fun. Like, even if for nothing else, you might as well. You're here for another few days.
Yeah.
Since I decided to stay. And so he pushed me to do a little trial at Hearth and at Spotted Pig and at Aquavit, like completely random set of situations.
Yeah.
I did them all and I ended up getting a job offered all three. And so I was like, wow.
How much time did you spend? A day?
Just like a day, like literally nothing.
Yeah.
But they had all needed, you know, they had a slot that needed to be spilled in each of the places. So he said, well, let's go look at a few apartments. And this was like now, I mean, David happens to be somebody who can do this to people, who can like kind of slowly edge them into something without you ever knowing that's what you're doing. Uh-huh. So we looked at a few apartments and then we signed a lease. So
why did he want you in?
Because he wanted me to be his roommate and he thought it'd be fun. Everyone was, you know, this was fresh out of college. Everyone's moving to either, you know, New York, Boston, whatever.
Right.
Coming from the Northeast.
Yeah.
And so we moved in together, an apartment in Lower East Side. I started working at the Spotted Pig, and that's kind of how I ended up there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how long were you there?
I was the pig for a year and a half.
Okay.
And then...
In what capacity?
I was just line cook.
Right through to when you left?
Mm-hmm.
What was that kitchen like?
Really fun.
Yeah?
Probably one of the best summers of my life was that summer working there. I met Anna, and I was just having a blast.
Yeah.
The kitchen was fast-paced. We were open till... But 3:30 in the morning or 3 in the morning, something insane like that. Again, I was just totally enthralled with the entire culture in all ways.
Was it mostly women at that point?
It was, I would say, when I left, it was easily 60% women in the kitchen. And the like sous chef, which technically at the Spotted Pig, the way it's set up is basically the chef because, you know, April's not always there.
Sure.
Was also a woman as well. So no, it was... always heavy on the women.
Yeah.
It was not it wasn't always all women by any means, but
And so, orient me time-wise here. You were so what year are we talking?
This is 2010, Anna and I met. Okay. So like 2009, I started there and then into 2010, the summer of.
Okay. And meantime, you were softening up to New York City. I mean, how long did it take you to sort of warm up to the idea
like
of being here?
Two months, because once I got into the kitchen and I, it's funny, I'm very adaptable. I hate change. Like, I don't like the period of it.
Yeah.
But once I'm into the next situation, I dive into it. That's and so, so it's funny. So funny because it's same way with travel for me. I don't like traveling, but I like getting to the place and coming back to it.
Yeah.
So once I was there, I mean, I got myself a bike and I was biking from the Lower East Side to West Village to work. Loving that aspect of things. I thought it was so fun and thrilling and the kitchen was awesome and I was meeting really cool people and staying out extremely late, smoking a lot of weed, drinking a lot. And then I met Anna. So like in the course of 6 months, I was living in every way what at the time felt like the New York City dream and then felt, you know, really hard and fast for my now wife. So very good year.
That's
definitely.
That's
a big moment.
Another movie.
That year.
Another movie for you.
Yeah, but there's many stories that would make it quite colorful as well. But it was.
But I mean, you shift to a whole different career. You move to a city you didn't think you'd ever live in. You fall into what ends up being the relationship of your life.
Through my roommate who had known Anna since she was 5 years old. On a night that I was super cranky leaving work at 2:30 in the morning, was again convinced by David to go out for a beer. And and Anna happened to be in this random gay bar that we went to.
Wow.
In sleepy West Village. Yeah. So it was definitely a good night.
It's amazing.
To say the least.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. So from there you go to where?
After that I called Aquavit back up because I'd obviously not taken the job in 2009. And I would, at the time, it's so funny looking back now, new Nordic cuisine, Scandinavian cuisine, no one cared about it at this time. But I was really interested to kind of diversify my resume in that everyone was doing French and Italian cooking or at the time, what would be what Spotted Pig was, I guess, gastropub, like bistro
pub,
food.
Yep.
And, I remember in one of the kitchens in Nantucket, one of the restaurants I worked at had an Aquavit cookbook. And I remember on moments where we had a few extra minutes in between family meal and kitchen, I would pick it up and look at it. And
this was the Marcus Samuelson book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was really intrigued by everything that was in the book.
Yeah.
And was curious about the restaurant. And at the time it wasn't hot, it wasn't cool.
Yeah.
But I was interested in kind of expanding my point of view on food. So I went back and said, you know, do you guys, is there any way you have an opening right now? And the time the sous chef that I had Saj Under was now the executive chef. So that was Marcus Jernmark.
Yeah.
He's now at restaurant Fransan. But he said, get on the line, start cooking right away. Like, just get in there. I was immediately pushed into the center hottest station on wow. on the line like the first night and for my stage. And at the end of the night, he's like, yeah, you can have a job.
Now, this is great. Interesting because you hadn't really cooked food in that style.
No, not at
even
all.
Close to it no. at these other jobs.
No.
Is this where your hands come into play? Your magic hands?
It was just, it
well,
kind
how were
of,
you able to even plate that stuff?
I just, well, that's what's so funny about it is that.
Because you're going from whatever you cooked on Nantucket to apply. I mean, well, April's food is great, but it's, you would call it rustic. It's not fussy.
True.
It's not what our late friend Josh Ozersky would have called tweezer food.
True, exactly.
And you're going to a place that has a lot more sort of finesse, precision, et cetera, on the plate. I'm
oh,
not
absolutely.
Saying April's food isn't precise
oh, yeah,
in its
of course,
way, but
of
it's
course.
Very, you know, lusty, yeah. You know, it's pasta.
Perfectly
and,
imperfect.
And nudie yeah. and burgers and to a place that has a lot of real sort of visual refinement, let's say, right?
Absolutely.
So how were you able to jump into
that? Well,
I
think that might have been where the artistry came
yeah.
in. But at the same time, I have a pretty strong work ethic and a pretty intensely self-critical, you know, viewpoint on my work in that to me, it was just get it done and do it right and don't fuck it up, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Failure
so,
is not an
yeah,
option.
It was not an option. Yeah. And I really wanted the job, too, because I wanted to work in, you know, finer dining and I wanted to do something that wasn't predictable in
right.
terms of my resume.
Yeah.
And I felt that that really fit the bill.
Do you consider yourself like, it's funny, because you so much of what you've done throughout your life is individual,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Art is individual.
Yeah.
What you ended up doing at Take Root, you
Absolutely.
Did with Anna, but
yeah.
you were the chef.
Yeah.
You were the only person cooking.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It was your vision,
yeah.
the food. But it is interesting. You did do two team sports
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
as a kid.
Yeah.
You did work in these kitchens where you were a cog in the machine, right?
True.
In those contexts, were you sort of a good soldier? Like when you just said failure is not an option,
yeah.
like were you a good employee, even as someone who ultimately would sort of decide you were going to take this on in a very unusual, independent, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. singular, one-person show kind of way?
Definitely reliable, hardworking, clean, efficient, all those things, of course. I got along with people pretty well. I will say it took me a long time to come to terms with how I left the Spotted Pig. It was not my finest moment. I did leave some hot pans on the flame and walk out. So I will say
oh,
that
you left
looking
in a huff.
Back on that. Oh,
oh
yeah.
Okay.
It was a bad day.
It sounds like you guys made your peace though.
Oh yeah. April wasn't even there for
okay.
that. And I recall, years later we saw each other at an event. And I like felt the need to, it was actually the Esquire Best New Restaurant list,
uh-huh.
party that we were on the list in the same time that Tosca Cafe was.
Okay.
And Josh actually said, oh, you guys have to meet. You
oh,
know,
this
I
was
know
the
you,
party at the Cecil?
Yeah, the Cecil.
Okay.
I said, Josh, I worked for April. We've met. And he goes, oh, right. Well, here, have a drink, talk.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I had seen her since I had left.
Right.
And
I should say, you're talking about Josh Ozersky,
yes,
who
Josh
used
Ozersky.
To be the food editor
yes, exactly.
at Esquire, who sadly, good friend of both of ours,
yes.
who passed away about 2.5 years ago. Anyway.
Exactly. And he, so he kind of walked away and I was standing there and I remember like my heart beating out of my chest because this was the day I left, it was a collision of a lot of reasons as to why I left. But
sure.
April ended up calling me on my cell phone that afternoon being like, are you sure? Like, you want to leave? Like, I think at the time it was me and a few other line cooks that were moving kind of faster up the ranks. And she was just about to finish opening the Breslin and the John Dory and all these other projects. And she notoriously hires from within. So I
mm-hmm.
think that to her, and to their, you know, their restaurant group, up and coming line cooks are future
yeah.
sous chefs and executive
yeah, yeah.
chefs. They,
yeah.
they groom them for that reason, which is, I think, a very intelligent way of doing things.
Sure.
And so I most certainly did have potential to move in that direction.
Yeah.
And I think it was a loss because I was dedicated and I was hardworking and I was talented. So she said, why are you leaving? Is there any way we can get you to come back? And I was a hard no at that point. And so I felt really shitty about it for
yeah.
a couple of years and felt like I couldn't move on emotionally from the fact that I did that to somebody who I genuinely considered a mentor and highly
right.
respected and
yeah.
wanted the respect of when I was doing my own venture. So I remember I was standing there like really nervous and finally said, I'm really sorry for the way that I left the restaurant. I'm like really ashamed of it. I want you to know that. And she was like, it's fine. Like basically I get it and whatever. Like,
these things
let's
happen.
Let's move on. And
yeah.
Cause at the time I'm standing there being recognized for my first own restaurant.
Right.
And she's standing there being recognized for one of her many.
Yeah.
And of course it's a slightly awkward situation, but
yeah.
it became a nothing after that momentary exchange of, and then since then, I think one other time I mentioned it again, she's like, you don't need to keep mentioning it and apologizing it. We're good. And Anna was like, will you stop apologizing about this? This was like a couple, even a year after that. And now of course, yeah, we're friendly. We were just texting this morning about, you know, the weather up here and yeah, seeing each other soon. But it is funny that when I look back on the question you just previously asked, was I a good employee? That moment still stands above all the others, even though I know in every other capacity I was a very good employee and a good manager at the time. I was, you know, sous chef at Aquavit by the time I left. But it just stands very clear in my mind as something I never want to repeat and hope no one ever does to me. So.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Well, I guess I won't ever repeat it because I don't think I'll be working for anybody else but myself, hopefully not.
You won't repeat it. I mean, if it does happen, you'll have the example of April's exactly response to it. Maybe you'll recognize it as a useful thing.
It happens. I mean, there was a lot going on at the time in my life, and it did really genuinely feel like the only option. Not something I'm proud of, but in the past.
Well, thanks for talking about
it.
I did want to say, though, but where my question came from was when you said the way you went into Aquavit, you know, and you were sort of this, I use this term, but failure is not an option. It did occur to me, I know you've had those jobs, but I never really imagined you in those jobs because at a fairly young age, you did open your own place and were doing your own thing. And it occurred to me, if I try to visualize you there, it's not that I can't picture it, but I did wonder how you were in that capacity, or were you someone, you don't strike me this way, but I did wonder, well, were you someone, you know, the genius who can't kind of get along, you know, with other, you know, did you feel kind of like you couldn't wait to be out of these situations? It doesn't sound like that at all.
No, it was.
I mean, not out of maybe the whatever happened at the pig happened at the pig, but in theory or in concept, you didn't mind being a line cook.
No, I enjoyed the idea of having to come together to create something and the need to be efficient and on the same page with another person to do it. But of course, there was always a part of my mind that thought it could be better if it was done this way. It would be more efficient if it was done that way. And I think that's when I got to the position of sous chef at Aquavit and I had more control. And I remember the first month that I was promoted, Marcus was traveling for 3 weeks. And I was like, what? Like all of a sudden, I mean, that's great. I feel honored that I'm getting this responsibility. And I was promoted to sous chef after only a month and a half of working at Aquavit.
Wow.
And he sat me down when he gave me the job and said, this is something that needs to be long-term. You need to stay for a long time. I only ended up staying for a year and a half. And that was partially because they ended up renovating the entire restaurant and closing it for a month. And I was like, I don't really want to wait around for that. And he said to me, like, you're going to have to be responsible for, you know, everybody in these ways. At the time, I think there was a staff of nearly 40 people in the kitchen, from dishwashers to line cooks, ranging from every possible ethnicity, age, sexual orientation, language, everything that you could even think of that would differentiate one person to another. And he's like, and you're going to have to find a way to like manage all of them individually. Not everybody wants to be yelled at. Some people thrive being yelled at. Some people want to be sat down and coddled. Some people can't speak English. So good luck with that. And all of these, you know, what he felt like were obstacles felt like to me like, okay, well, I'll just apply a different manner of teaching or management to each person and figure it out. And I thought it was, again, another situation where failure wasn't an option. If I wanted to do a good job, I had to figure out how to do it. So I adapted. But
I'm also assuming a lot of these people were probably older than you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the line cooks at the time, which was kind of hilarious, just to paint a picture, Aquavit has a lot of cooks that they put on visa. And they're at the time, the three main line cooks were all taller than 6 feet.
Yeah.
Very burly Swedish men.
Okay.
With, you know, blonde hair. None of them would speak English on the line. And I am, well, 5'3".
Yeah.
A little tiny 20 something year old gay woman.
Yeah.
Telling them what to do. It was not the easiest of experiences, but they were pretty humorous about it and didn't give me a hard time, but it did feel energetically kind of comical.
Yeah.
But no, I did always have a need or a desire to kind of want to do my own thing.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So how did you start conceiving of what became Take Root? When did that start to come together in your head?
Anna and I conceived of it together. We were walking on her parents' property.
Which is
really
where?
Beautiful, outside of Baltimore, in Owings Mills. And we kind of sat down on the stump. I think we most certainly had a joint in hand, so we were definitely floating somewhere in our minds. And we said, we really want to work together. What, in what capacity? But I was like, well, I'm a chef. Like, I'm going to be working in restaurants. You know, I'm a cook. I want to be doing that. So unless you're working in restaurants, like, that's not going to work. She said, what if we did something together? Okay. She's like, I want to see you more. I don't like, I never get to see you. And this is coming from somebody who at the time was kind of unclear about what she wanted to do. She had been doing some nonprofit work, but certainly restaurant wasn't the path she was taking.
Yeah.
And we had just moved to Brooklyn and had this beautiful backyard. I said, why don't we just like take some time to garden and chill out and let me figure out where I want to go. Like maybe, but probably mm-hmm. not. And then we started, you know, hosting people in our backyard and we started doing some stuff together and eventually started charging money for it. And then our neighbor shut us down because she said it was illegal because we were living in a co-op. And that's when we kind of looked at each other and said, we need to get a commercial space. Are we actually doing this? Is this just a fun thing? Or are we going to do a restaurant together? And that's when we stumbled around the property that would become Take Root.
Yeah.
And it was 650 square feet, no closets, no walk-in, no kitchen. It was just a single room that was a number of different things in the past on a very pretty sleepy residential block mm-hmm. in Cobble Hill on right near the BQE. So
yeah.
In no capacity did it look like it could ever be a restaurant.
Yeah.
But it was extremely low rent all the way till the day we left. One that in the future we were able to pay off in only one night of service a month. So oh, well. When people question or wonder how we were even able to survive, there's yeah. the answer. And we thought, okay, well, we have to do something that's going to fit in this space. So we didn't conceive of the idea and then find a space.
That was my
for
next
it.
Question. Did form follow function or was
yeah.
it the reverse?
Yeah, no,
you,
it was.
The space presented itself and then you backed
we
into
built
the rest
a kitchen.
Of it.
I had $14,000 in my savings. I was like, okay, I'm going to buy the appliances for the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And then where can we get, you know, some seed money to rent, to build the kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
And our parents helped us out. Very minimally, but enough to
yep.
literally put three walls on the side of the kit, on the side of the appliances that I brought, two of which wow. broke down the first month and I had to buy new ones. Never buy used appliances to anyone who's listening.
Right.
And we had one singular bathroom and literally, I mean, not a single closet or drawer to store anything, not even like yeah. a pen and a pad of paper. So it right. was, that was it. And so every single thing had to be made daily. We could never make anything ahead of time because we didn't have anywhere to store it. For the kitchen. And we only had enough room for 12 seats. So thus began Take Root.
Amazing. Was it always going to be a tasty menu restaurant?
Yeah. Because we could control, there was no way that we could do it any other way. I mean, we had to know exactly how much produce to buy and where it could be stored. I mean, there was no right. capacity in which we could have an a la carte restaurant in there.
Yeah.
I also wanted to do that.
Yeah.
And it was something that we could do alone.
And what did it take? So you guys, you were open how many nights of service a week?
Three nights.
Three nights a week. You would spend the other
all
part
except
of your time
for Sunday
getting ready.
Oh yeah.
So how many hours a day were you in there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday getting ready for Thursday?
Yeah. So Sunday was our only full day off.
Mm-hmm.
Though for me, I was usually over there taking out trash or doing
right,
something.
Sure.
Monday was usually our kind of what we would call the half day.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I could go in any time of the day that I wanted to. Either I could do the half day in the morning or the half day in the afternoon. So I could either go in at 11 and come home at like 7, or I could go in at like 9 and come home at like 5.
Right.
And that was kind of our routine. We'd meet, I would go over what wine was consumed. I would make the menu. We
yep.
would discuss what we needed to do for the week. And that's when I would get things that required time, like stocks and whatnot going.
Yeah.
Because those were things that I could leave and not pay attention to, but also do bills and talk
yeah.
about wine, everything during the same time. And then Tuesday, Wednesday became full prep. I mean, I was going to the markets all by myself, walking to them, toting back bags and taking in deliveries and
right.
butchering and whatnot. And then prepping all day into the night, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then Thursday, Friday, Saturday service. So it was the same routine for 5 years.
Did you enjoy going about it that way from the beginning? Like, did it feel good?
It was the only, yeah. Oh yeah. It didn't feel
it didn't not feel lonely.
It didn't, no, I mean, and that's the thing that's so interesting is it is very, there's a stigma around calling being a chef an artist, right? Everyone knows that it's hard to say that. There's a lot of reasons why people have problems with it, but how was what I was doing any dissimilar than an exhibit, right? I'm in my studio all week. I come up with a thesis. So mm-hmm. 12 different pieces of art, individually composed plates.
Yep.
And then I have a group of people coming and consuming it in some capacity. So this
right.
way through their mouth versus through their eyes and then leaving.
Yeah.
Sounds to me like a gallery opening, right? And so to me, that's how it felt. I mean, I was in the kitchen by myself, usually dead quiet until
yeah.
the last like 6 months before we closed, I started to listen to music, but I was oddly regimented with myself the same way I would be if I had staff.
Well, what's so here's what's been said on this season, right? Because I said earlier that it's come up a few times. So first show we did, Alex Stupak was on, and I posed this question. And Alex's feeling was that, you know, art to him is meant to evoke an emotion, and food ultimately is meant to be pleasurable, right? So I think if as long as you have the priorities straight, it's all okay. But his point was, you know, if you start getting into a place where you're trying to evoke a negative emotion through food, that can get murky. That was one point. Massimo Bottura, who I'm not sure what sequence our interview will air, but our 10th episode, when I brought up the question, there's a lot about his stuff that to me seems very, like he mentioned Duchamp in our interview, and I thought that's perfect for what he does.
Totally.
But what he said was, he said, no, he likened it more to being an engineer, right? Where your first priority is you have to build a fast car. Then it can be pretty or whatever. And in his feeling, food, first of all, had to taste good. And then it could be clever or this or that or whatever. Those were the two main, I guess, not even detractors. Those were the two big qualifiers, I guess, that have been put on it. Does that make sense to you?
It totally does. It's funny. I've always played with the two words comfort and intrigue for me for food. I feel like a successful dish balances both of those things. Yeah. So, and for then taking it further, a successful menu balances those things. So for me in the tasting menu, the first, you know, three smaller things would fire out pretty quickly. The pace was set. Maybe one of them was intriguing or an unusual ingredient or an unusual preparation. And then there was this moment in the meal every single night for 5 years that the brioche and the brown butter would come out. Now, this is something that is like pretty universally enjoyed. Like, who does not love a big slice of warm bread with butter? Yeah. Both took me many months to develop the recipes for. I wanted to do something that was different than sourdough, that was just really comforting. And this was like a huge hug. Like the moment in the room, it smelled like a Wonder Bread factory. Yeah. Everyone was dead silent. And so that was the comfort. And then right after that, you'd come back up to something that was intriguing or challenging, whether it be, you know, a lamb tongue or whatever.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was this kind of roller coaster of pushing and pulling the diners into comfort and intrigue, challenging them and then consoling them. And the idea of finding that balance, I think, to me is what, you know, I wouldn't say successful, but what a meaningful dish is.
Yeah.
Or a meaningful chef's point of view or a meaningful menu. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I came there the first time, I remember writing a note the next day that it was instantaneous. Well, first of all, there was the whole move. It was very intimate. I mean, 12 seats, which included what, four at the bar?
We had four bar seats, a table for four, and two tables for two.
Yeah. So I had one of the tables for two. I was over with my friend Evan Sung.
My favorite table, actually. Yeah.
You know, I know Anna created a different playlist for each menu.
Each season,
Each season. And we were just immediately, it was like meditative, but not solo. I mean, we were having dinner together. We were plunged into really deep conversation. Then we'd stop and talk about the food, and then we'd go back to whatever we were talking about. It was amazing. I mean, to me, it was just a complete...
I appreciate that.
Singular home run. I mean, I really can't think of another meal quite like it that I had.
That's a good thing.
And the fact that you know, and Anna were bringing the food out, it was only the two of you. And then I also found it rather, I guess, touching. I mean, maybe for you it was a pain, but I remember we were the last ones out and you were already, like, you were doing the dishes. Which is like, hasn't she done enough? I mean, I remember thinking, like, hasn't she done enough?
No, it's funny because you hear a lot of, very traditional chef's point of view on the industry of how things should go, right? So you work as a dishwasher or a prep cook, then you move your way up, then you work as a line cook, then you do this, go through the ranks, then you have earned the possible option to open your own place or do your own thing.
Yeah.
And for a very long time, almost still to the present, a lot of chefs still believe that that's the way that it should go.
Yeah.
And I felt that, okay, I'll do all of those things, but not in that order.
Yeah.
I will wash dishes. I'll take out trash happily. Yeah. I will bring out dishes. Yeah. I will serve them. I will bust the tables. I will greet the guests, but I'm going to do it in my way and I'm going to make it meaningful.
Yeah.
I'm not just going to wash the dishes so I can say I was a dishwasher once or I paid my own bills. I'm going to do it because I cooked for these people, so I'm going to clean up after them. And that was a mentality that was instilled in me at a very young child. I would want to go into the kitchen and experiment and make myself something to eat. My mom would say, that's fine. You're doing the dishes after. You're not going to get the fun part, which is the cooking part, and then not the other part. You cook, you clean. It was never a divided responsibility. The person who cooked didn't then give the cleaning responsibility to the somebody else. Yeah. It was, you're doing both. Yeah. And so when I started Take Root and we talked about hiring other people, and I said, I don't think it's necessary for a number of reasons. We had personal and professional reasons, but also later down the road, years after doing it over and over many times, I became a completionist. I had to do the dishes. Yeah. I felt like my night was not over until it was done.
Finishing the job.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Yeah. When I used to do, I used to go cook at friends' home. I've never been a professional cook, but I'm a pretty good cook. And I would always do, I would always insist on doing the dishes afterwards. I never really thought about why, but I used to jokingly say, I'm going to finish the job.
Yeah.
It's like, it's between me and the kitchen.
It's true. And it feels like in a deeper kind of more emotional place, it does feel, it's that humbling part of cooking for people.
Yeah.
It's very easy, or I shouldn't say it's very easy. That's not appropriate for any of the other chefs who are listening. It's a different level of comfort being a successful chef and having recognition via, you know, awards or achievements or features or people telling you you're wonderful. And then at the end of the night to kind of walk away from the kitchen and have other people clean up after you or do the rest of the work. But there's something very different being both those people.
Right.
If you've been a dishwasher or a prep cook, I'm sure you have. But have you also at the same time been the person getting the recognition? Probably not.
Right.
And that is an unusual and very special experience that I got to experience, being both the person who's taking out the trash and dripping whatever's at the bottom of the trash can all over my feet in the morning after a really hard service, and then also cleaning the vegetables, placing the orders, doing payroll, and then on top of that, getting the pat on the back. It's also the people in one person.
Not to be corny about it, but as someone who was literally an artist, I think about someone cleaning their paintbrushes
Right.
I mean,
I think that there was this mentality when I was a younger line cook that I always wanted to be the person that, oh God, I just can't wait to have somebody else do this for me, somebody else to sweep and somebody else to, you know, clean up after me. And I can't wait to put on my apron and my, you know, my white coat and walk through the dining room. And that was like very early on in my career because I thought that's going to be when I've made it, right?
Right.
And it's so funny now after the experience I've had, even this weekend we did a small event and I went out to talk to some people after and I was like, I went back into the kitchen to Anna. I said, I really don't like doing that anymore. And she was like, well, why? What's wrong? I was like, you know, I'm much more comfortable just cooking and kind of being quiet, because I think that's really why we're all in it, is to cook and to make people happy through food. And everything else that comes with it is just what comes with it.
Right.
But to have had that intensive, immersive 5 years of being every possible person in a restaurant.
Yeah.
In one body.
Yeah.
Wow, I wouldn't trade it for anything, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. So you guys, after five years, pull up stakes.
Yeah.
What prompted that?
We had decided probably a year before we closed that we wanted to close.
Mm-hmm.
We felt the creative project was coming to an end. Like, we didn't have anything else we wanted to do within the project. We didn't feel like there was any potential for it to be sustainable long-term for a number of reasons. First of all, the property wasn't sustainable.
Yeah.
The model obviously wasn't sustainable. Anna's interest in terms of how she wanted to be a role in our project had shifted, and then thus that would have completely changed the concept if we changed that.
Yeah.
And then kind of the two major reasons were, one, we wanted to move out of the city.
So
that wasn't possible to run the restaurant not being there. And then lastly, I had a really rough emotional kind of health year leading up to it. And it became clear that with all of these variables in one pot, that, you know, the recipe was going to lead towards closing the restaurant and moving at some point.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was how we were going to do it, when we were going to do it, became the mystery.
Right.
And that is where I have kind of coined it this divine intervention from the universe. The lease at Take Root was up the same time our house went, that we got our offer accepted. So to us, we felt
on the house
like
that we're sitting in right now.
So we felt like, well, that's it. The answer's done. I mean, we're not going to sign on for five more years because that was our option, because we knew that was not even an option. So therefore, okay, that took care of closing.
Yeah.
Where are we going and where are we going to move? House. Okay. That takes care of that. Let's go.
Yeah.
And it became an obvious choice, a difficult one, mind you, but it didn't feel like something we could ignore. Yeah. Once those two things fell into place, it became clear.
Now, you've alluded to it twice. I don't know if I should be asking you or not. Your health,
certainly. Yeah. Best way to put it, I had a nervous breakdown, I guess.
I was
not aware of what that looked like in any capacity up until it happened.
Came out of the blue?
Oh, very much, yeah. You and I think on one of our first times we met, had exchanged some dialogue on a little bit about my family. I knew what it looked like from an outsider's perspective, but when something's happening to you, it's sometimes a lot harder to identify.
Totally.
It came completely out of nowhere, October of last year, so a little over a year ago. Major physical reactions to stress, just couldn't breathe, couldn't sleep.
Wow.
Really terrible migraines, crying more or less every other day. And not in ways of depression and you know, sadness, in ways of like deep, deep anxiety. I was like not able to function.
Yeah.
And we had a couple incidences that started to give us major warning signs as to something was wrong. One service in particular stood out that at the very last course I dropped it and I went out to the back of the restaurant and started just projectile-y throwing up because I was that anxious, that freaked out by the fact that I was serving people and what was going into this and who was I and what was happening and all the critique and what the industry has become in the, I would say, last 2 years at this like light speed of social media and criticism that people are capable of via, you know, Instagram and Yelp and all these things. I mean, I felt like it was a completely different world than it was 3 or 4 years ago.
Right.
And I could not handle it. And not because we were receiving negative criticism either. It had nothing to do with that. It was the prospect that every single move that I was making was being watched.
Right. That one misstep could cause the whole house of cards to topple.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is how we live now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, I was not making any time for anything other than work. I mean, zero. I mean, I wasn't exercising.
Right.
I wasn't seeing friends. I wasn't seeing family. And I had completely shut myself off from the possibility that I could ever get better and instead just pushed through and kept on pushing myself beyond every possible sign that might say stop, 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 stop. And eventually I just pushed myself into a very serious nervous breakdown.
Wow.
And at the time it was beyond overwhelming. I got brain MRIs and EKGs and CAT scans and all these things because the physical aspects were so severe that a number of doctors thought there had to have been a reason for this. Yeah. There was no way it was just caused by stress.
Right.
But eventually it was clear that it was, you know, a panic disorder of some kind.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you're doing, I mean, I don't want to get too personal.
Oh,
about
no,
medication
no, no, no,
or
no, no, no.
Whatever,
I don't take
right?
any medication, talk therapy and lifestyle change.
Did you improve almost immediately after shutting the restaurant?
Yes, but also it took some time because I also at the same time was then like mourning the loss of this place that
and probably anxiety about did we do the right thing?
Yeah,
we just bought a house.
It's funny, when we made the decision to close the restaurant, it was great. Yeah, I can't wait to start something new and move upstate and all the possibility. And then about a week or so before we moved, I had like, what are we doing? This is craziness. Like we literally just signed away all of the potential to do anything else in the city. And what are we doing? This is insane. The second we had our last box unloaded and we shut the door behind us and realized this is it, this is the only place we have right now. And this is where we live. Switch flipped. I was stoked. I was on like cloud nine, pure bliss.
Wow.
Couldn't even think about anything other than how happy I was. And the lifestyle up here, the nature and everything has definitely helped a lot.
Yeah.
For sure.
How about winter coming? Does that take its toll or
like I actually really
the
love
shorter
winter.
Days? You're okay with that?
Yeah. I've never really suffered in any capacity from seasonal affective disorder. I love winter. I love cooking in the winter. It's my favorite season to cook. Probably because of, you know, the anxiety of all the options in the summer freak me out. It's like when I go to the farmer's market and there's like 15 different kinds of vegetables. I'm like, what the fuck? I can't cook all of these.
Okay. So I'm not a chef,
but
we go to the farmer's market in Hastings every Saturday morning.
Yeah.
I get a coffee. I get a breakfast from one of the people who has breakfast. I do a lap. I can't.
Yeah.
I can't decide.
No.
And then I go home.
Exactly.
Empty handed.
Nothing more. And it was
so
funny at the restaurant because anytime I was ever interviewed about, you know, what's your favorite dish to cook? What's your favorite season? And, oh, you must really look forward to tomatoes or berries. And I was like, I really look forward to potatoes and beets.
Right, right.
I feel like with the limits you can do, and maybe this has something to do with the restaurant creating limits for me in that I couldn't do things that I liked you know, less options meant more possibility to create something that wasn't already existing for you. At the same time, less to work with was more to work with in a weird way.
A structure.
What,
so what about moving forward? What do you, when you think about the future, I don't want to give away any secrets, but what do you see for yourself or the two of you? What are you, or is Anna done with the business?
No. So Anna is kind of somewhere in between waiting for me to make a decision and also waiting for herself to make one. But no, she'll absolutely be creatively involved in whatever I do next. Yeah. Most certainly she will not be working on the floor.
It's a good thing to know.
Done with that.
That's a good thing to know about yourself.
Yeah. She did an incredible job with our wine list way before natural wine was important. Yeah. She was doing it, which was pretty cool. I always called her the mood setter of the restaurant because she did everything except for the food. So she's got a knack there creatively. So I'll want to use that. And we love working together in a certain respect, but not with customers. We didn't like that very much.
Different styles?
No, we just didn't like the interacting with the customers.
It
became too much towards the end. We were in a very vulnerable situation. I mean, we were married, we were young, we were gay, and we were the only people there. So every single customer a night, 144 dishes a night, we interacted face-to-face with these people.
Right.
You learn a lot about people and dining and how people dine. And, I have decided what I want to do. So conceptually, I'm clear.
So you have a...
Yep.
There's a target.
Yeah.
Okay.
Financially, we're not there yet. Yeah. And finding the exact location, not quite there yet. There's a lot of options up here. There's a lot of beautiful places that are available and a lot of abandoned places that are beautiful, but none have like connected in the way that I want it to, because I want whatever we do next to be long-term, sustainable, my final hopeful forever venture. Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
So it's a little bit more thoughtful than it was in the first time.
So it's an exciting time.
Yeah. I'm really excited. I feel like there's endless possibility at this point.
Great. Well, it was great to see you.
Yeah, it was really nice to have you up
Thanks
here.
Thanks for sharing so much.
Yeah, of course.
And and thank you for lunch.
Thank you.
That was
a
treat.
I just appreciate
I had Elise Cornex cooking, everybody. Yeah. I'm the most recent diner.
I'm just really grateful that you took the drive up here and got
pleasure.
To do it.
I think right after I announced the show, you reached out and you were on
I
really wanted to have you on the first season. So
I appreciate
we were both
it.
Thinking that way.
Absolutely. And I always think it's funny when you invite people up here to come see you. Everyone always finds there's one other thing that they get to do, which I always love. It's like, you're not just coming to see me, also to see a friend or dine out or go take a hike. And so it's like two birds with one stone thing.
You're maintaining my privacy, but yes, I'm going from here to a tennis match one of my old nemeses from our Columbia County days.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm going to go across the river. I'm excited.
Yeah, make it worth your drive.
Oh, it was already worth it. Yeah. I have to say, it was funny. This morning I got up and it was a big rain yesterday. And then this morning the sun was out. It was crisp. It was clear. And I turned to Caitlin, my wife, and I said, it's a perfect day
The
drive.
I know.
There's just nothing like it.
No, it's totally true. I mean, there's a lot of things up here that take an hour to get to just because that's how windy the roads are, how long it is. Yeah. And it's about the journey, not the destination.
Yeah.
You get to really enjoy it, for
sure.
Totally.
Yeah. All right. Great to see you. Happy
holidays.
Thanks
for coming. You too.
And that's our show. A huge thank you to Elise Cornack and to Anna for letting me crash your new lives up in Saugerties, New York. It was great to see the two of you. And I'm not too proud to say that I did pay that visit to my old tennis nemesis, Nick Patton, a most talented painter. You should all look up Nick Patton. He's awesome. And he took me out. I think the score was 6-2. Six love. I know the second set was definitely six love. You don't forget those. I think I was lucky enough to get two games in the first set. And it's just a shame because I was feeling so good until that happened. It had been such a good day up to that point. Nick, I'm going to get you next time. Thanks for listening, everybody. As always, if you'd like to follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, the handle is @ChefPodcast. That's @ChefPodcast. And you're more than welcome to follow me personally on Twitter and Instagram as well. That handle is @ToklandAndrew, TOQUELAND Andrew, a huge thanks to our engineer, David Tadashor, as always, for splicing these things together. And I have not been thanking her, but I do need to thank my wife, Caitlin, for joining me and making these intros to the show less painful for me and hopefully more enjoyable for all of you. Thanks for listening, and look forward to seeing you back here next time on Andrew Talks to Chefs.